Well, first, the temperature in Russia after President Putin's mobilisation decree. Last week, he announced that 300,000 reservists would be called up to boost Russia's war in Ukraine. Media reports say people with no military experience or who are too old or disabled are being called up. There's growing public opposition to the draft, with thousands of Russian men leaving the country to avoid being sent to war, and sporadic protests, particularly in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Meanwhile, the United States has warned Russia of, quote, catastrophic consequences, unquote, if nuclear weapons are used. Andrew Roth is The Guardian's Moscow correspondent. He's been in Russia's capital for a decade, previously reporting for The Washington Post.
This is the moment when the war comes home for most Russians. You know, as horrific as this war has been for the last 7 months, people in the country have been able to ignore it to a certain degree. And I think that now that's more or less impossible. So from what I see, it's pretty much every family and pretty much every man, you know, who could possibly be drafted into the army, deciding if they want to do that, if they want to flee the country, recognizing that, you know, this war is suddenly going to affect their lives. And I think it's really raising the temperature among people here. So far, we've seen that the Russian government wants to call up somewhere like 300,000 men, but it's possible that the number could be far higher. And that means that, you know, basically call up papers are sent to men around the country, and you can be in the trenches in Ukraine within just a couple of weeks, we think. Based on my reporting, you know, in some small towns or villages, they're called povestki in Russian, call up papers are being sent to nearly every man in the town. So, you know, this is something that is affecting communities. It's obviously going to affect the economy in a huge way. And we are seeing some signs of protest in response to it. You know, these include the kind of standard protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But we also see in some places, in small towns, the people kind of really going after and getting angry at local, you know, draft officials, people who are supposed to be kind of running this, people yelling at police, sometimes people fighting back against police. Although in most cases, those protests have been put down. And then the last thing that we've seen are, in rare cases, a kind of very desperate reaction form of protest, you could say. But you know, it seems more like a kind of desperate acts over the war, including a young man who walked into a draft center today and shot the local military commandant point blank. It was caught on video. In another case, a young man lit himself on fire at a bus station in Ryazan, which is a city about 4 hours southeast of Moscow, yelling that he didn't want to take part in the war in Ukraine. So what you can say is that the temperature here is going way up. This is, for Russians, I think the most significant thing that's happened since the very beginning of the war, since February 24th. This is probably, you know, the kind of most influential moment since then.
What are the scenes at the border? We're getting some reports of significant numbers of people crossing out of the country.
Yeah, I would say tens of thousands of people are leaving Russia right now. You know, obviously, this isn't most of the population because many people here don't even have a foreign passport. But it's a significant outflow of people who have decided that they need to go right now. They don't want to take part in the war, or they just don't want to be drafted. A lot of European countries have already closed their borders, land borders out of Russia to Russians. So it means that people have to go through Georgia, go through Kazakhstan or Mongolia, or you can try to fly, but tickets have also gotten prohibitively expensive. I saw, you know, charter flights for $10,000 a seat to Dubai. So a lot of people are really, you know, willing to spend a fair amount of money to get out. At the moment, you know, there's an expectation that the borders are going to be closed within days. Many people think for young men, you know, or men from age 18 to 65, this is something that's been in place in Ukraine since the beginning of the war. But with Russia, I mean, people could leave, enter, etc. That's all coming to an end now. And it's possible that martial law could also be instituted by the end of the week. Which will also place limits on movement. You know, you can't leave your region and you're already not supposed to. So, you know, I have friends who basically grab their car and said, I'm going to try to go to Kazakhstan just to get out of the country. And so we're seeing a lot of people having the same idea, massive traffic jams on the border. We're talking 10 kilometers, maybe a day of waiting. And then hopefully you're not turned back at the border, because if your name is in the list of people who've been called up or could be called up, then you could also be turned away. I would also just lastly say on this group of people that I think they're less politically active, and they're less political activists among them than people who left in March or February. You know, a lot of these people are people who probably tried to ignore the war or avoid kind of having any problems with it. Maybe they had to, maybe they opposed the war and they just stayed because, you know, they had responsibilities here.
Are we seeing any form of organized protest or resistance, Andrew? We've seen some numbers of people arrested. Is it stable? Is it growing? What's happening with respect to overt resistance?
I don't think that we're seeing really organized resistance. No, I think we see occasional protests in places like Moscow and St. Petersburg, but the police handle them fairly easily. You know, these are kind of middle-class Muscovites who don't really fight the police. So they, you know, people come out, they get arrested within maybe an hour, and that's kind of the end of it. I've been here for 10 years. I've seen much bigger protests than the protests that are taking place now. People are afraid. The topic's difficult, but also we just don't see the kind of protests that we've seen in the past. But the other thing we see is kind of random protests, random acts of protest, I'd say. Small villages where all of a sudden everybody gets together and yells at the local draft official because you don't know what else to do in this case. You know, these are small communities where everybody knows everybody. And that's the kind of situation, you know, it's more decentralized across the country.
So the draft papers are being issued, and then what is happening? Is there a physical mobilization actually underway?
Yes. I mean, people, you get the draft papers. Sometimes you need to show up within an hour of getting them. You go to the draft committee. If they approve you, you know, you're supposed to pass a kind of medical test. You're sent for basically preparation for war, for training. So that should be months. It takes a while to train soldiers. But in this case, we know the Russians need to get bodies into the trenches really quickly. And to the front to prop up their position. So we're hearing that people might be sent there as quickly as 2 weeks from now, from when they're kind of drafted. Most of these people should have some kind of military training or even have served in the military. But in fact, sometimes, you know, people actually don't know what they're doing. So there are questions about the effectiveness. We'd say somewhere in tens of thousands have already been picked up. I don't think we're at a number like 300 yet, but maybe somewhere between 60 to 120,000 people could be mobilized, trained in some way, and then sent to Ukraine or to border regions in Russia, I'd say within the next couple of months.
At a high level, there is a real rise in rhetoric, to put it mildly. The United States says it has warned Russia at all levels of a, quote, catastrophic consequences were Russia to use nuclear weapons. The US would respond, quote, decisively. And the US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, Washington's message, issuing this message, reports saying Washington's message had been more detailed in private conversations with Russian counterparts. Can you elaborate at all about what you're hearing in Russia itself on this latest communication?
You know, in Russia itself, I think that the rhetoric is totally obstinate. There's no sense of the kind of gravity of the moment or of any sense that there's any kind of vulnerability or willingness to negotiate on these topics. You know, the Russians are being very aggressive, and you could almost say too aggressive. In terms of the nuclear threat, I think when Putin announced it originally, he said, this is not a bluff. Quite a few people have noted that if it's not a bluff, you don't need to say that. You know, people who say this is not a bluff are often bluffing. So what we know is that the threats have been made, but there are a lot of questions about how actually serious they are, how much they can come through on it, and to what degree this is just nuclear blackmail. You know, this is an attempt to basically freeze the war in East Ukraine by telling the Ukrainians and the West that if you continue to advance, we're going to use nuclear weapons. So you have to deal with us, listen to us, and agree to our terms. The Ukrainians rightly are calling that nuclear blackmail and don't seem like they're going to listen to the Russian terms. So I think that to this day, to this point, you know, nobody, a lot of people don't really trust, I think, in the Russian kind of threats. And there's also a sense that regardless of the situation, that Ukraine and also its Western allies kind of need to stay the course in terms of this. You know, they can't really be threatened away from liberating this Ukrainian territory by this kind of this Russian threat.
Is it, however, the most serious rhetoric between both Russia and the United States that we have heard in, goodness, recent memory anyway? How is it being received as a moment in time?
That's fascinating, but honestly, to be clear, like in Russia, mobilization is the topic. Nuclear war is barely mentioned, I have to be honest, among people I talk to, just because, you know, the here and now is the kind of question of the society being mobilized for war. That said, you know, based on the facts on the ground, people who are kind of following this, including kind of officials, are saying that to a certain degree, I mean, they hear rhetoric about nuclear weapons in the Kremlin and among people who are close to the Kremlin, and they seem intent on delivering the message to the West that the Kremlin is serious about the threat. So they're really interested in the West taking this threat seriously. And yes, this is, you know, one of the most serious moments, I think, in decades. It's difficult to go back to a period of time that was this dangerous and where the kind of conflict is so heated. And people rightly compare it maybe to a Cuban Missile Crisis or something like that. I think that that was a little bit more serious than this threat at this point. But we're headed for a very big contradiction between the Russian and, you know, the Ukrainian / Western side, which is that Russia is going to annex territories in East Ukraine and say, these are our territories, you know, permanently. You can't go back from that. They can't negotiate those territories away. And as Ukraine, you know, rightly believes that this is its own territory, because it is, that is a recipe for a kind of perpetual war. And if Russia decides that the threat is so great, I mean, it is also a recipe for some kind of vast escalation. So, all the kind of ingredients are there. The question is, I think, how far the Kremlin's willing to go, and whether these threats are real. And in the end, I think that there's a certain amount of uncertainty. We don't know.
Where are we at now with these referendums in four areas that Russia is trying to bring in and officially make Russian territory? Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson and Zaporizhia. Of course, a lot of scepticism. In fact, that's not even an appropriate word, around the so-called referendums. But what is their status now? And how does this feed into President Putin's next moves?
Yeah, so, you know, this is kind of play acting of a referendum. The idea is to fake a vote that would say that these territories want to join Russia. It's impossible to poll people in a territory that's occupied, that you don't totally control, where people have been driven away by the war. You know, there's no way to hold a real vote on this topic. And you can't hold referendums on somebody else's territory and ask them if they want to join your country. So the referendums, you know, as themselves are bunk, but they're part of a larger strategy on the Russian side to basically justify the annexations. So what we're going to expect to happen this week is that the results, quote unquote, of these referendums, quote unquote, is going to come in tomorrow. That's when voting ends. And then some point after that, you know, the Kremlin will announce that we've received the results of this vote and these territories all want to join Russia and we're going to grant it. So, you know, they'll sign it here in the upper house of the upper chamber of the Senate, and then it'll go to Putin for signature. So it's pretty simple and straightforward. And the Russians probably by the end of the week will claim to have annexed these territories. Ukraine obviously won't recognize that. Neither will the rest of the world. It will be extremely divisive and roundly criticized by every other country. And I think then we have a question basically, which is going to be when the war continues, because I don't expect, you know, Ukraine will stop trying to fight for its own territory. Will Russia declare, you know, a full war, a state of emergency, martial law? What will be Russia's escalation following that? That's the question that really matters, because I think we know what everything else that's going to happen this week looks like.
That annexation, of course, then puts President Putin in a position to saying, I am now defending Russia's territory, which plays back into the rhetoric we have just been discussing. Is there any, and I know this is difficult and a source of constant speculation, is there any sense of any loss of confidence or support in Putin himself among those around him? Is he himself playing, I guess, on the strategic high wire right now? And how on earth could we discern that?
This is a huge, you know, crisis inside of Russia, both in public and in private, you know, and for people in the Kremlin as well. It's probably the most dangerous moment in Putin's 22 years in power. You know, it's never been so tense, so dangerous, and the stakes have never been this high. You know, in order for Putin to lose his grip on power, it's not just that he needs to make mistakes, but that somebody else would probably have to capitalize upon them. Somebody would need to step up and do something about what's happening. I'm watching the protests in the country. I see a lot of tension. I see a lot of anger, but I don't see something that looks like the kind of movement that could really, you know, undermine the government, because this country has a lot of practice at putting down protests, and just because I think that there's so much resistance, I think, among ordinary people to protest or come out against the government, that's hard to watch. You know, as it comes to what's going on inside the Kremlin, obviously there's a lot of loyalty to Putin there. These are people who've been with him for two decades or longer, you know, and it's very dangerous to move against him. So we hear things about the idea of a palace coup to unseat him, but we don't really see that happening. But that said, there are lieutenants, people like Ramzan Kadyrov in Chechnya, people like Yevgeny Prigozhin, who runs this Wagner private military company, who are becoming very powerful, I think, during this conflict. You know, their power is growing. These are guys who are either radicals or just they are extremely dangerous, I think, to a certain degree. And we can see the seeds for what would be a pretty unstable, you know, situation in the government once this all finishes. The technocrats are losing, and these real soldiers of fortune, I would say, are kind of coming out on top. But the real question is, you know, at what point does one of them decide that Putin needs to go? And is that not too dangerous? So we can see the seeds of something like that. But it's hard to say that Putin is losing his grip on power right now.
We just see Putin overnight granting citizenship to Edward Snowden. I'm not sure if it has any relevance at all to anything that's going on at the moment, but what do we know about him and his status?
Yeah, I think it's just bad timing for Edward, isn't it? He did, in fact, apply for citizenship 2 years ago. We know because he said so. Putin does this quarterly where he gives out citizenship, but man, what a moment. You know, coming right when this war is taking place during the mobilization, and then just days before maybe Russian citizens will be banned from even leaving the country because of, you know, a state of emergency. So we know that Snowden has been here since 2013. I was one of the people who was looking for him in the airport when he flew into Russia. And his family is here at this point. He's had kids here. He still lives a more or less hidden life. Largely outside of Moscow, but claims to walk around kind of incognito. And, you know, he talks a lot about the issues that he always has about, you know, privacy and data security. But he's very careful, I think, talking about the war, talking about Russia, talking about what the agreement is in terms of how he lives here. And to be honest, you know, before the war, enjoyed making fun of foreign reporters for reporting that there was going to be a war between Russia and Ukraine, and then kind of took a step back after the war actually started. So at this point, his status is that he's a Russian citizen, naturalized. I guess he remains an American citizen as well, even though he doesn't have a passport. He's here. His lawyer says that he can't be drafted for the war. I'm sure that's very comforting. But, you know, obviously, he's in an extremely cloistered situation. It's very hard to come out of this, or come back from this. So it feels like just a bit of a kind of ironic moment, a slightly funny trolling moment to give him a passport, I guess, just as this is happening, you know, just as the country is plunging deeper and deeper into isolation.
That is Andrew Roth, The Guardian's long-serving Moscow correspondent. I was speaking to him just before we came on air this morning.